Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
All right, folks, welcome back. And this episode, I'm joined in the first half or thereabouts of Your Money Today by my old buddy, Ryan Sistad. Ryan is from Duluth, Minnesota. He is the chief cook and bottle washer at Better in Our Backyard, an organization that you've heard me talk about a lot now for the last few years. We cover them as one of our favorite causes on Strategic Media's website. And of course, Ryan and I overlap on a lot of different resource stories and public policy issues in the U.S. because as his company's organization, I should say, name implies, Better in Our Backyard, it's all about getting the public ever more so around the idea of, hey, we've got to start carrying our own weight for our own economy when it comes to production of different metals and critical minerals and all of the different parts of the food chain pertaining to those. So, Ryan, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's always
Hey,
a pleasure.
Always. Look, we're going to cover, when you and I are done with a few specific subjects, I'm going to cover in the back half of the podcast some other subjects that pertain to the economy and the markets, especially from the first frenetic and high-charged first few days of Trump 2.0. But I want to visit with you for a minute on what you may be hearing about some of them, because, of course, one of the first things that the president did when he sat down Monday night at the Capitol Center, first of all, or whatever corporate name they call it by these days, and then back at the White House in the Oval Office, he signed a number of executive orders that impact some of the things that you follow and some of the companies that you follow and that you and I have in common. So tell us about your initial impression of some of his permitting related executive orders.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, so far, it's obviously been extremely positive. You know, the Ambler Road project is now back on track after one of his executive orders. He's directed the Department of Interior to focus on reinstating some of their permits. That was one of the four or five main key projects that have been hindered or delayed under the previous administration. So I think that's a huge sign of things to come, not just for, you know, the Ambler Metals project, but also for other projects like Twin Metals or Resolution Copper, and even some other projects like maybe even New Range Copper Nickel's North Met project, or even the Pebble Mine potentially in Alaska. This is definitely a good sign of things to come. I mean, the Bureau of Land Management too. I mean, I want to say Governor Doug Burgum, but now he's the Secretary of Interior, Doug Burgum. You know, he's already directing the BLM to, you know, review some of their mine permitting rules to create a more efficient process that includes, you know, from my understanding, just from doing a quick read, he's looking to set some timeline expectations, which is good. I mean, these companies need certainty in the permitting process. And so in my estimation, I think he has done more for permitting reform in his first week of office than the previous administration did in 4 years.
Oh, I'll definitely second that. And, you know, we need to distinguish, of course, folks, between what the president is able to do unilaterally, which, roughly speaking, is to immediately undo the things that President Biden did unilaterally. So, for example, we'll go down the list of them here quickly. Before we move on, Ambler Road was the first one you mentioned, Ryan, and that's a project up in the state of Alaska where the specific issue was that Deep Six, that project, at least for a while, that's a copper gold project, if I remember correctly, up there.
Yeah, and I think they're targeting some amounts of zinc, too.
But anyway, what the Biden administration had done was to not allow road construction through a certain area that would allow for equipment and eventually ore and concentrates or whatever in and out of this particular site. So because that was something done by an administrative decree. And I don't remember at the moment if it was Biden that did it unilaterally or his interior secretary, who was a disaster by and large, did it, or which one of them. But anyway, that was something that Trump could unilaterally do. You might be able to help me out on this one, though. Twin Metals, we mentioned that. And of course, in the Arrowhead region of Minnesota, you're in your neighborhood, just up to the north and east of you, are two major projects next to one another. There's North Met, which is now a joint venture after all of these years, when it used to be owned by a company called PolyMet, and Glencore took. Basically took over a while back what it didn't already own of PolyMet, and then they joined forces with Teck, correct? All right, so they've got a joint venture company. New Range Copper Nickel is that company's name. And then to the northeast of it, up closer to Ely, you've got Twin Metals. And Twin Metals is the one where, here again, by a unilateral administrative or executive move, the administration under President Biden just up and canceled the permit. That is something that, now, have you heard yet yourself? Because I've not been able to find this specifically. Did one of President Trump's executive orders reinstate that, or is that still something on the drawing board?
I believe that's still something on the drawing board. And then, not to correct you, Chris, but they, so you might getting the with the Twin Metals project, they didn't get a permit yet. The issue was is that they're on mineral leases on federal lands, and they just basically revoked their rights to those leases.
Revoke the lease. All right. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks.
No,
Thanks for
no worries.
straightening that out.
No problem. But they did take away, well, under their watch, not technically the administration, but under their watch, right? Or under their direction. One of the main key permits for the North Met project was taken away, which, to your point earlier, is just south of Twin Metals. So yeah, there was two pretty big copper nickel projects that were hindered. And I would say it's North Met Twin. Twin is still on the drawing board, but to the point earlier with Ambler Metals, I just think, to me, in the previous administration, the five key projects that were huge, massive copper projects that were delayed was Resolution Copper, Pebble, Ambler, North Met, and Twin. And what I really love about that executive order, or just even the looking at reinstating the permits for the Ambler Road project, the Mile Road, that would make the project economical, is that I think it is a sign of things to come for Twin Metals. So it hasn't happened yet, but to your point, I would not be surprised if it wasn't on the drawing board, like meaning something's going to happen in the next month or two.
Sure. Well, one way or another, I'm sure it's going to get taken care of. I know that,
No, I mean, yeah,
I know that
it's
Congressman Pete Stauber, your congressman up there, whose district encompasses those projects in the Iron Range, that he was talking about, if necessary, he would try and introduce legislation to do it. Whether he has to go that far in the end, who knows? That's something to be determined. But in any event, it's been a while now, but there has been some slight movement in Congress, even while Biden was still in the White House, to start to do something towards speeding up, the permitting process, having a bit more certainty. I think one of the bills, and you remember this better than I will, one of the bills last year was to put a time limit during which, or I should say, after which, lawsuits were barred on granting certain permits. So that's one of the reasons why, and I've told people countless times that when it comes to North Met, the project up there, it's hard to believe it has been a quarter of a century since I first personally set foot on that ground. And for it to have gone all this time, when we're still not anywhere as close to producing, is a crime. And part of the reason for that is that there are so many bites at the apple that our current structure allows for anybody that you don't even have to live there. Anybody to come in and challenge it legally, and okay, now you just added another year or two and lots of money. And frankly, and my heart breaks for the people who owned PolyMet for a number of years. It was one of the top 10 recommendations I ever made in the National Investor, but we sold our most of it way back before everything crashed in 2008. We traded in and out of it a couple of times afterwards, but unfortunately, I was proven correct at the time that, the time and the attrition and fighting all these legal battles were eventually going to caused Polymet to lose it to a bigger company that was able to continue the fight, which is what ended up happening. So that stuff has happened. But, I was talking to Congressman Stauber, a couple of his legislative aides, a couple or 3 weeks ago. I think it was right after the first. And we were discussing the whole thing. And, look, everybody agrees that all the reform of permitting that's already happened, but much more that's to come, it's all good stuff. The whittling down the administrative state, whittling down the regulations, all that kind of thing. But we still have economic issues that need to be addressed. And I mean, even if tomorrow all of the permitting roadblocks were out of the way, how do you see things up in the Iron Range as far as the economic environment? Is there enough funding going to be available for these companies to get developed and actually be producing? Is there enough labor, et cetera? So let's talk about your area first.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Iron Range is just, I mean, it's been ready for an economic boom for decades. And there's a reason why you have companies like Teck and Glencore continuing to be interested in investing in that region, because there is so much potential. And so, yeah, I do think the funds would be there once it gets permitted. They're, technically in year 19 of permitting, going on to year 20. So we have a generation of kids that have graduated high school to learn about a project, not to see a project come off the ground. We have, investors like yourself that, have known about this project, have been following about this project for over 20 years that have yet to see it happen. So, yeah, I would say that once it's fully permitted, I mean, they will get the financial backing that they need. And the same goes with Twin Metals. I mean, their parent company is Antofagasta. And yeah, I mean, even with permitting reform with Twin, just so, the audience is aware, NorthMet has a couple key permits left to make sure that it gets through litigation. At one point, it was fully permitted. With Twin, they simply just want to go through the permitting process. So we're still looking at another, let's say if permitting was absolutely fixed, leases are back, all that stuff, you're still looking at 5 to 7 years, right? So, and I'm not speaking for them when I say that. They probably would give you a much different timeline than I would to that question, but that's just me going off of, what I've learned in the past. And but yeah, it's absolutely ready for a boom. I mean, Minnesota as a state has been growing quite a bit. The last 40 years, the state itself has grown by over 40%. But during that time, there's many Iron Range communities that, have decreased in population during that
Right.
same time frame, 20 to 30%. And so I think you would see a lot of people from the cities that are from that area or different parts of even the country that, if they start seeing an economic boom coming back to the range, they might have some opportunities to move back home. Which how often do you see your friends, or like, I have friends that, want to move away to the big city, and now they're, yearning to get back home, and they somehow make their way back, 20, 30 years later. So, I think the range is ready for a boom, and I think they have the workforce to do it.
Yeah, well, and more so than the most places, because for a lot of people that don't know and have never been to northern Minnesota or not familiar with the area, of course, the iron from the Iron Range built much of the industrial Northeast and upper Midwest way back a century plus ago during the Industrial Revolution. So it's
Yeah.
not like mining.
Supplied 77% of steel too, for
Right.
st or iron ore for steel making
Yeah.
during World War II. There's an old senator named Tom Bach. He retired years ago. He used to be the Senate Majority Leader, even ran for governor, but he's kind of the Joe Manchin of the Minnesota Senate for the longest time. And he jokes, but it's not also the truth. It's a joking truth, or it's a joke with a lot of truth, that we wouldn't be, we went to one World War II without Minnesota's Iron Range. And then
Right.
you'd also argue, like, when you're talking about how Polymet would have been one of your, top stocks that you would have recommended. Well, why wouldn't have you? Because of the rich mining history already in northeastern Minnesota. You think that regulators at that time and legislators would welcome another mine being opened when at that time they were already proving that we've been mining iron ore safely for 100 years, so, or for a century. And yeah, it's a lot of rich mining history in Minnesota.
Well, but all of us, and you made a good point when you mentioned, Ryan, that even if you could get all the permitting stuff under everybody's belt, you're still talking about several years in most cases for a lot of other studies to get done, for economic assessments to be completed to the point where the companies, to the extent they need it, can raise the project financing to do all of this stuff, the money that's still needed. You're talking about many, many billions of dollars. And this is where one of our big disconnects are. as a society, I think. We need to rearrange our priorities. And I think rhetorically, President Trump is doing some of this in pointing out that we need to reinvigorate at a much greater speed our domestic industries. But, a company just went public today that's an LNG tanker, company at a market cap of $60 billion. President Trump's dopey meme token, whatever the hell it is, he and Melania each had re their respective these phantom tokens, going tens of billions of dollars in of so-called value that materialized overnight. And yet we're in a situation where, whether it's in the Iron Range, whether it's in Montana or, Idaho or Wyoming or Arizona, Nevada, wherever the case may be, a lot of companies are having a hard time raising several billion dollars for something that's real, that's in the ground, that's in front of them, and that we need to extract for our economy. And they're not doing it because I think the culture needs to change around to where people need to understand that these real things are needed in our society too, not just these flash in the pan crypto tokens or some of this other stuff. And also because there needs to be some pricing certainty. And I don't know how much you've looked into this yourself yet, Ryan, but for instance, one of the things, again, I visited with Congressman Stauber's people about is that, and they agreed with me. Yes, permitting reform is going to be great, and streamlining all of that is desperately needed. But we're in a global pricing environment where the U.S. has a hard time competing against cheap foreign imports. And the question is, what do we do about this? I mean, let's focus on nickel, which is the most egregious case. The global price of nickel right now is around 15,000 some odd dollars a ton. At that number, nothing in the US gets developed because no one will ever lend the money for it because the average company with first world costs and wages here in the US can't make money at that number. So, what have you seen as far as whether it's companies in the Iron Range or in your other travels? Because better in our backyard, though you started in the Iron Range and with Minnesota companies, now you're more national. You follow stories and have companies among your members from numerous states. What do you hear about how we're going to tackle that issue?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, the easy one to point to is tariffs, but that doesn't fix all your problems too, as we've talked about in the past. I have to be straight up. I don't focus too much on the pricing, but I do focus on, the investments coming in. And when you're talking about, pricing being low, not necessarily. I've seen it, with nickel, or you're looking at some proposed projects across the country, like Talon. Their stock is pretty low, and it has nothing to do with how great of a project Talon is, because I think they have a great project. It's because pricing is low in nickel, as you know better than me. I mean, Chris, like, but some of the things I like to think about is, like CK Gold in Wyoming, or Highland Copper in Michigan, the Cactus Mine in Arizona. These are junior mining stocks that have been hovering around the same price. At least I know that with the Cactus Mine, Arizona Sonoran Mining Company's stock. And this is a fully permitted copper mine, and they don't have the financing to build and they the to build a new copper mine. I mean, maybe they do now today. I don't know. I don't want to, again, I don't want to speak for them. It's none of my business to really know, I guess. But I mean, they've been permitted for over a year. Why aren't they building the mine?
Well, good
Like, we're
question.
talking about copper projects being an issue. We're talking about copper demand doubling by 2050, but yet we have four to five fully permitted copper projects across the country, and they're not being, I mean, when you look at the projections of copper, and you look at, it's kind of like, well, it's kind of like crypto. When Bitcoin goes up, Ethereum and everyone else goes up as Bitcoin goes up. The same goes with metals. I mean, if copper's going up, chances are nickel's probably going up, and everything else. I know there's probably some special cases, but there's something, it doesn't make sense because the demand is projected to double, and so copper prices is expected to go, but yet the investment isn't coming into the US. And so, I would say it's a mixture of tariffs, but again, that doesn't fix everything. And then secondly, there needs to be a better attitude about mining. And I think we're seeing a pretty seismic shift here in the last 2 weeks with this administration. I think this administration is sending a clear signal that in terms of mining, we are open for business.
Well, look, you and I are going to revisit this in the months ahead, I'm sure, either on this platform or otherwise. But in closing, Ryan, and I agree with you that I've been saying to people already that there's a lot of hurdles. There's a lot of things I think even the president has not quite come to understand yet as just how big this job is. It's way past a few executive orders to undo some of the damage that Biden did on permitting and whatnot. There's got to be a wholesale top to bottom reordering of priorities nationally to make sure that the kind of money that the tens and hundreds of billions of dollars being thrown at AI or whatever, say, hey, we need infrastructure, we need energy. How about a couple of bucks over in some of these areas too? And I
Yes.
think that's going to come because necessity is the mother of invention. But in closing, how do you see the coming months playing out as far as your role is concerned? Do you see it easier now to go to, and you just had your winter dinner, you had huge attendance, it was a smash success. Congressman Stauber, a lot of other important people were there, so congratulations on that. I regret I didn't make it at the last minute,
Well, we missed you. Yeah.
but we'll get together again shortly. But how do you see things as far as your role in the coming months to try and help push this cause forward even more?
Well, I see it being a lot of fun. I mean, I noticed it with conference season last year, and it seemed like last 4 years, each year got a little bit more grim and grim. And I don't want to say grim, but you can just tell the energy in the room. And I guess with the dinner last week, we had over 500 people in attendance, and the energy was really good and vibrant. I think that's because people are confident again about the industries that they work in, and I actually see my job not really getting easier over the next couple of months. I see it getting a lot busier, but in a good way, and I see it being a lot of fun. And
That's
I mean, I
good.
see it being a lot of fun. We got a bunch of content that we're pushing out today and tomorrow, and it's just all good news. It's fun. It's fun if you're working in the mining industry now.
Right. Well, if
But it
everybody
wasn't
played.
fun before, but now it's like we're actually celebrating some wins,
That's good. Well, if everybody plays their cards right, and the president gets the better people around him, he's already doing a lot of that, and we start adding more to the tasks that need to be done to really turn us around in a big way, it is going to be a good time ahead for the country. I mean, by rights, we should have a boom. Canada, with even more untapped resources than we have, should have a boom, and we've got all kinds of runway in
And
front
even more
of
of a
us.
boom if they become a 51st state, right? No, I'm kidding.
Well, the funny thing is, you mentioned
Kidding.
I was actually talking to someone up there today, a mining company executive, because, and I'm going to mention this in the next segment of the podcast, so I'll save most of that. But I kind of gasped when I looked at the computer this morning and I saw that Doug Ford, who is Ontario's premier, has called an early election. And I first read it incorrectly, thinking that, he was trying to force an earlier federal election because, of course, Prime Minister Trudeau is dragging this out agonizingly for the Canadian people before there's a new federal election. But no, Doug Ford is going to have a snap provincial election because there's no leadership on the federal level in Canada, and he doesn't want to surrender that for Ontario because by rights, it should be Ontario saying to America, well, we've got way more natural resources as a percentage of our overall economy that haven't been exploited yet. Maybe we should be dictating to you how things are going to be.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens. I mean,
Is
there's
Ontario kind of like their Texas or something, or what? Like, are they kind of the where they could just go on their own if they felt like it type of thing, or
Who,
pretend? I don't know.
Ontario?
Yeah. I don't know much about
Well, look,
Canadian.
several of the provinces in Canada have got very strong economies, independent of the federal government. And I think the distinction in Canada, not to get too far afield for present purposes, is sometimes a lot different than it is between, U.S. states. You've got some U.S. states that pay more in taxes, get more in benefits and stuff like that. But there's always been this idea, especially when it comes to resources, especially from the western provinces, not so much Ontario. But you look at provinces, especially like Saskatchewan and Alberta, that many times have threatened that we want to be part of the U.S. and, they appreciate us more than Ottawa does, kind of thing. But anyway, this is all going to be work in progress. What has made things more entertaining, but at the same time, for some more exasperating that are trying to make plans, is that we've got the big dog back in the White House in the U.S. and he wants everybody to know he's the big dog. And there's going to be bluster and threats and this and that and negotiating tactics that you never know what's the next day is going to bring. But anyway, for when it comes to resources and whatnot, I do believe that the net result is going to be very positive, and you and I are going to have both a lot of fun as our activities overlap in some of these areas. So, folks, make sure that
Sure.
if you've not previously visited Better in Our Backyard, you do so. All of their contact information will be in the notes along with this episode. And Ryan, thanks, my friend, for taking a few minutes today, and we'll look forward to circling back before too long.
No problem, Chris. Thank you for the opportunity.
Take care. Now, my thanks to Ryan, and we're going to move on with several different topics of what we saw and heard this week. I think, first off, as so many people have pointed out, even the president's detractors, we've got a very different aura about the White House, about the presidency. One commentator put it, we've gone from Droopy the dog to Sonic the Hedgehog. No one in their dreams could imagine President Biden sitting at the Oval Office desk, that resolute desk, and signing executive orders one after the other, giving some commentary on them, and in between answering questions, rapid fire from the press in attendance. If it was all Joe Biden could do to get the pen in his hand and figure out what line to sign on, etc. So, someone else put it, Trump is back. He's got an edge to him. This term is starting off with more urgency and energy and certainty than Trump 1.0 did. One of the people in his inner circle commented, we're going to break some China, but we're going to make some changes. So, there's been a frenetic pace of activity for the last several days, starting on Monday. There's been some great pardon decisions. There's been some great decisions on suspending virtually all foreign aid until there's an investigation into what's going on. I was happy to see that the president specifically called for an investigation into the whole Biden and Ukraine grifting operation that has cost hundreds of thousands of lives, as well as hundreds of billions of dollars along the way. There's not going to be even any new loans and grants come for critical minerals, good or bad, from the Energy Department, from the Defense Department, until all of that is sorted through. I think here, the president, some of this, of course, is opinions and themes and whatnot. In the same way that President Biden had an attitude that we're going to follow themes and causes and make the policy comport to that. I think that there's been a bit of an overreaction by President Trump and maybe some of the people in his inner circle just because it was something that Biden pushed to want to undo it. I don't think we're necessarily going to see a wholesale undoing of the so-called IRA, Inflation Reduction Act. A lot of these things, of course, benefit red states more than they do blue states. But there are going to be some changes, and a lot of these things are going to be pieced together in the days and weeks ahead. Once you get Chris Wright confirmed as Energy Secretary, once Doug Burgum is confirmed as the rather Interior Secretary, once Howard Lutnick is confirmed as the Commerce Secretary, we'll start to see more meat put on the bones of things. But no, unquestionably, there is a better environment, I think, for business generally. For our own domestic extractive industry specifically, than anything we've seen in many decades in this country. I think it's great. I'm happy about it. I want to see the president succeed. And I think in some ways he will. And in many ways he already has, as this first 4 or 5 days has shown us. It was interesting and to some people downright exhilarating to see President Trump this week lay down the law in numerous ways, even get some of the globalists over in Davos, Switzerland, shaking in their boots at the World Economic Forum this meeting and having to concede in one way or another that Trump is back on the world stage and they're going to have to adjust to the changing political realities and sentiments the world over. You know, I've said in a couple of contexts that the president has the potential to not just reorder things in the U.S., but in other countries as well, especially where things like unchecked immigration, economic issues, regulatory issues, taxation issues, and so forth are concerned. Now, as always, being bombastic might come back and bite him in a few ways. I need to talk about a couple of those right now, especially where energy is concerned. In case someone forgot to tell President Trump, Saudi Arabia, which is swimming in money, the Middle East is generally, and unlike China and America, the Middle East, as it's going to become even a bigger driver of economic activity and investment in the years ahead, is not doing so going forward, saddled by choking debts, as is China, certainly, and even the U.S. So, yeah, it's great that we're going to see Saudi Arabia pump a bunch of investment into the U.S., but I certainly hope the president's not holding his breath thinking about things like Saudi Arabia is going to lower oil prices to 50 bucks a barrel or something like that just to help him look good and make him look good. There is such a thing as the Vision 2030 program in Saudi Arabia. They have budgeted for an oil price more along the lines of $80 a barrel. And for a lot of reasons I've talked about previously, and I'm going to bring back my main theme for 2025, and that is let's do the math. I'm sorry, Mr. President, but unless you or some other outside force bring about a major recession in the U.S. and the global economy, it's pretty much mathematically impossible to have the oil price come down like you think it can and should. Inflation has taken everything up, including cost to energy companies in recent years. And here again this week, and when I put out the next issue of the National Investor in the next several days, I'll be making specific reference to this, as well as some of the other things I'll talk about. You know, the executives of energy companies, to a man or woman, as the case may be, are pushing back on this and saying, you know what? Don't hold your breath that we're going to be able to increase production, for example, in the U.S. if you get Saudi Arabia especially to push prices down. We're not going to invest the kind of money and manpower and personnel and everything, all of which is in short supply, to increase production if it doesn't make economic sense to do it. And so that's something that is going to have to be reckoned with by the president. Maybe he knows this deep down and this is political posturing, I don't know. There are other things he can do regulatory wise and whatnot to help reduce costs and the burdens on energy companies somewhat, and some of the early executive orders of course go to that end as well. But I think that people are out over their skis if they're investing based on the notion that he is going to be able to bring down energy costs significantly. I think quite the opposite, not because it's his fault, but because there is just so much demand as time is going on. Now, some of that, of course, is going to be driven by AI. And we had a big ceremony at the White House today after the inauguration where he had Mr. Altman and Larry Ellison and Mr. Sohn from SoftBank there talking about the hundreds of billions of investment that is going to come into AI facilities and capabilities in the U.S. Sounds great, especially if it all works out. I personally throw in with Elon Musk trying to figure out how Mr. Sohn and SoftBank, a company that has about $120 billion in net debt that it owes, is going to be throwing the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars more around for this kind of thing. Well, what do I know? Maybe I don't know the math when it comes to that. But hey, clearly, whether it comes through or not and all of these things, whether, you know, some of this is just pie in the sky optimism that's going to be whittled down. We all remember what happened with Foxconn in Wisconsin during Trump 1.0 and how that big initial announcement ended up being a shadow of what was promised because reality and math set in. But hey, clearly the president is a magnet for people with money, for companies, domestic and otherwise, that want a piece of what they believe is going to be this new golden age that he's going to unleash. And so there's certainly going to be no shortage of companies that are going to feel ever more these animal spirits. Those animal spirits, of course, in recent days have resulted in Wall Street after being almost, solidly in a new downtrend with a correction unfolding. Now all of a sudden has been back on the upswing in the last several days with the S&P 500 breaking that downtrending channel that I have told our members about, and now pretty much tagging, if not slightly exceeding, I think late this last week, its all-time high. But reality is going to set in a pretty big way this coming week. It's going to give us ever more of a circus to watch, I think, in some ways, when the president more forcefully takes on a character by the name of Jerome Powell, who runs this little central bank called the Federal Reserve. You know, I had to laugh when the president made the comments he did on Thursday about, well, if I can get OPEC to take oil prices back down and that reduced cost of energy reduces the inflation rate, then I'm going to demand that the central banks all reduce interest rates. After all, I know interest rates better than even Jerome Powell does. Well, Jerome Powell is going to express a different opinion come about 2 o'clock Eastern time this coming Wednesday afternoon, when the Fed, as is widely expected, sits on its hands this time around after having reduced the federal funds rate, that's the short-term interest rate that they set, by a total of 100 basis points in its last three meetings. It is not going to be reducing interest rates again right away. He may, Powell, I mean, in his press conference after the meeting, repeat in some fashion, they actually probably will, that number one, they've got to see how things with inflation turn out. Inflation, as we all know, has stayed pretty sticky, more so than not, for several months now. The president's tariff policy and how that may or may not impact things is yet to be determined. Frankly, all of these animal spirits and a record high on Wall Street, there simply is no urgency, as the Fed sees it certainly, to lower interest rates any further. So they're going to sit here possibly for many months, depending on what goes on with the economy. Of course, that's always subject to change. The president's not going to like it, and guaranteed very soon after the Fed meeting on Wednesday, you're going to see a new round of public browbeating, which, as you remember from an earlier episode of Your Money Today late last year, I said is a battle the president would probably be well advised not to engage in. There are things he can do to take his economic policy future out of the hands of the Federal Reserve, everything from the National Infrastructure Bank, which I've championed, to a national currency system. Even Ray Dalio this last week suggested that the time is coming because of these choking debts, and exactly because the Fed sitting on its hands and enough members of Congress and the Senate are going to use this as an excuse to not want to have aggressive pro-growth tax policies, to not want to have aggressive pro-development policies, because everybody has got used to all of these things are impacted on the federal budget. Let's do an end run around this. And so even Dalio suggested this week that the time is coming to look at an alternative currency regimen of some kind. You can have a national currency system, still use the dollar, it's still the same currency, but like President Kennedy did once upon a time, it's a United States note, not a Federal Reserve note. And you regulate the quantity and value of that with a currency board. You don't need this central bank. So that's a bit much, I'm sure, right now for the president to grab onto, but it's a discussion that a lot of us are going to further. But that not being the case for the time being, I think we're going to see a pretty big reality jolt post-Fed this week, where I think the stock market is going to have to reckon anew with the fact that the Fed is going to stick to its guns and it's not going to be cajoled into lowering interest rates when there are reasons that inflation is going to go higher. You know, going back to the energy mix just for a minute, not only is Saudi Arabia going to be very reluctant to follow the president and drop oil $10 or $20 a barrel just to help him out when it's going to hurt them, but look at the other foreign policy issues that, if anything, may keep a floor under oil, if not push it up. You know, we're looking at renewed sanctions and putting a hammer down again where Iran and Venezuela are both concerned in different ways. And even the threat, if the president doesn't like the way negotiations are going to be going, of added tariffs or sanctions or both on Russia and its energy production. So you can't have all of these things and all of these tough and hawkish foreign policy measures, which might push oil up $5 or $10 a barrel, all else being equal, and therefore keep inflation percolating, if not moving a bit higher, and get your way with the Fed reducing interest rates. Not going to happen. About the only consolation prize that may come out of all of that this week will be that if the Fed, as everybody, including myself, expects, sits on its hands and does not lower short-term rates any further, that will be a signal to the markets, most importantly to the bond market vigilantes, that they are not going to knuckle under to the president and push rates down and risk an even bigger inflation rebound. And that, if anything, is probably going to cap long-term interest rates, all else being equal. That's the way it should turn out. You know, on that score, of course, as I always do, I'll be doing a podcast very soon after the Fed meeting, at the least with my old friend and colleague Mike Fox at Prospector News. We always cover the Fed meeting after the fact on his podcast, so be on the lookout for that late in the week coming up. And I'll probably weigh in further, either on Your Money Today or otherwise in addition to that. And it'll be interesting to see how the dollar responds to that as well. The dollar has had a fairly notable pullback at last after a strong run it's had for the last few months or so. A lot of that was based on, well, pretty much two things. First off, at least so far, we'll see if the president meets his February 1st deadline or not for this. We have not had any official announcement as far as new or augmented tariffs on the president's part. So that is one reason why the dollar's come off the boil. Another, of course, was late in the week when the president was suggesting he wants to see interest rates pushed down and presumably the value of the dollar along with that. But that's still something that to me is quite uncertain. You know, there are reasons, and I've said this several days ago, there are reasons why. If he's going to follow through and try and make a deal of all things over Greenland, I mean, he's not kidding about this. And this is far from the first time in U.S. history that a U.S. president has said that we should have more control over Greenland strategically and economically and for raw materials and all of those different reasons. You know, you want a strong currency for that if it's justified. So this is still going to be a work in progress. I wouldn't get my hopes up that the dollar, if you're betting on that in the currency markets, is necessarily, for now at least, going to continue its downward move, this correction that we've had recently. Because if the Fed holds pat, it makes clear it's not going to move. That could just as easily put some steam back into the dollar, all else being equal. So that remains to be seen. One nice thing for you gold bugs out there this week is that even though a lot of the gold equities didn't participate that much, gold itself has rebounded on all of this various uncertainty, and we're within a whisker there of a new nominal all-time high for the gold price. So we're going to be watching that as well to see if there's a breakout, or at the moment, I would bet slightly more on this scenario, whether gold is still held in check post-Fed meeting, when it's clear that the Fed is not going to move quickly, certainly not as quickly as President Trump wants to do that. Now, moving on, I want to mention at least one more thing right now, and that's this whole tariff thing. Look, President Trump is in a very strong bargaining position in some respects over tariffs. An interesting angle to the whole thing with China that emerged late this last week is that there's some mechanism, and I think this is really curious if this is how the president is going to make his decision on China tariffs generally. But there was a suggestion this late this week that if China is amenable to a deal to give 50% plus one of the shares or some facsimile thereof of TikTok to a US-based entity and give them control so that TikTok can be saved, which now is part of the president's agenda, then he may be a little less harsh when it comes to tariffs otherwise on China. That's interesting when at the same time there are these ongoing threats of tariffs against both Canada and Mexico. And that's going to be interesting to watch in the coming days on a number of counts. I mentioned when Ryan was on here earlier that Doug Ford, Ontario's premier, is going to have an election late in February. He wants to make sure that his political capital and power in the province, at least, are galvanized while we wait and see how the national political situation is going to sort itself out or not, as the case may be. Ford, I think, correctly understands that for all of President Trump's talk to the contrary, Canada is a very critical partner. Already, where energy is concerned, they export 4 or so million barrels of oil a day, which is exactly what some of our refining capacity needs, is specifically that kind of oil. So that cannot be replaced anytime soon unless we're going to import more heavy oil from Venezuela. And as I said a few minutes ago, if anything, Trump is going to put the screws more so that Venezuela can't do anything, nor can any U.S. companies operating down there. So that all is going to be a work in progress. And it saddens me for all of my very many friends and colleagues in Canada that they're going through their own purgatory right now politically. The national political landscape just got a bit more interesting for those of you who follow it, or I guess I should say for those of you that don't follow it that much either. I mean, on the surface, the Liberal Party in Canada is about where the Democrat Party was in the US coming into our election back in November. It doesn't matter. You could bring Mother Teresa back to life and run her as a Democrat candidate down here, and the country was just so sick of the Democrat Party and Biden and Harris and the rest of them. All of the woke crap and all the rest of it, that didn't matter who the nominee was, Trump was going to win again. Likewise, in Canada, the country is so sick of the Liberals and Justin Trudeau and the rest of it for over a decade now, that it on the surface, it doesn't matter who they're going to bring out. Pierre Poilievre should, by all appearances, be the next prime minister. But problem number one for Canada is that the way that the prime minister resigned and put parliament on ice for better than 2 months, etc., it's going to be at least late May or early June, and the best case scenario, before you're A, going to have a new Liberal Party leader, and B, logistically, you can have a national election. That's number one. Number two, and always am asking the opinions of all of my friends in Canada as to this situation, but I was somewhat surprised recently to see that Mark Carney was throwing his hat in the ring to be the Liberal Party standard bearer. Carney, of course, is a former governor of Canada's Central Bank. He also, for a while after that, moved over to the UK and was the head of the UK Central Bank. Now he's back in Canada. And, he is obviously, on paper at least, a much more formidable candidate than Chrystia Freeland or anybody else that's mentioned would be. So, depending on how all of this shakes out, if Carney ends up being the Liberal standard bearer, this may not be quite the shoo-in for Poilievre that a lot of people think it will be. That remains to be seen. I'm hopeful for my friends in Canada that he is still the winner. The conservatives have been way ahead in the polls recently. I've not seen a recent poll that shows him stacked up against all of the various liberal possibilities. But this is a work in progress. And so for the moment, at least, it gives President Trump the seeming ability to continue to play tough with Canada. I don't frankly understand what the point is, because you don't have a leader in a country right now. You have these provincial premiers who I think are trying to make amends and get the U.S. to understand that we can have a positive, not an adversarial relationship, much like Premier Danielle Smith when she went to Mar-a-Lago, and then she was, I understand, at the inauguration as well. Alberta, of course, is a big exporter of energy to the U.S. So, look, a lot of this, like the president loves to do, is talk and bluster. We'll see what happens. A much different situation exists to our south, and that is in the person of President Claudia Sheinbaum of Mexico, where I have to say that my view is that the president's got a bit more than he bargained for with her. You know, she replaced AMLO, as we all called him, President López Obrador, who personally, he and Trump got along. They're both, they both fancy themselves as big dogs, and they've got the same kind of personality. I think they respected one another on a personal level because of being so similar. She is much more of a technocrat and pragmatist, even though she is still, you know, the same party, the Morena party. And look, they're basically a one-party state these days in Mexico. They have such overwhelming support. And so she is not going to be a pushover for President Trump in any way, shape, or form. She is already ruled out, despite President Trump's various promises of bad things that will happen otherwise. She has already ruled out any early renegotiation of the three-way trade arrangement between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. It used to be called NAFTA. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, the president is going to push here and push there. He'll retreat. Of course, his MO, everybody knows. That doesn't mean you shouldn't take him seriously. But his MO has always been that he can speak loudly and carry a big stick. But in the end of at the end of the day, it's all transactional. It's all about making a deal. I think he's much more savvy as the second term starts out than he was the first one, by his own admission, obviously, as well. So we'll see what happens. But for present purposes, we'll end there for this week's episode, give you a little bit of a break so we don't go over the hour mark. But I'll be back with you late next week or next weekend, because there will be fireworks following the Fed meeting, possibly in the markets, but most certainly between Messrs. Powell and Trump. So I'll look forward to sharing all of that with you not many days hence.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to chris@nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.